I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate that end product to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in. Today's guest is Dr. Will Siu. He completed his medical and graduate school at UCLA and the University of Oxford, respectively, before training as a psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School. He remained on the faculty at Harvard for 2 years prior to moving to New York City to further pursue his interest in psychedelic medicine as a practitioner and public advocate through speaking, writing, and social media. Dr. Will has been trained by MAPS provide MDMA-assisted therapy, and maintains a private practice in Los Angeles, where he provides individual psychotherapy and ketamine-facilitated psychotherapy. He approaches his work with the goal of lasting patient-centered healing, using his skills and experience to help his clients find healing within themselves. As part of that process, Dr. Will manages psychiatric medication, including medication discontinuation for those who are ready, and provides integrative psychotherapy. For interested patients, this involves meditative and spiritual work, and in some cases, ketamine-assisted psychotherapy by oral lozenge or intramuscular injection. For me personally, I met Dr. Will after Sebastian's traumatic birth. After 6 months of regular talk therapy, I was looking for something more. And thankfully, Elise, the editor at Goop, introduced me to Dr. Will. I spent 90 minutes in his office and gained more in those 90 minutes than I had in 6 months of therapy. This is my experience and a little introduction to the world of psychedelics. All right, well, welcome to the show. I've been waiting patiently, watching your little name on my calendar get closer and closer to the date of recording. So I'm so, so happy to have you here and to talk about today about different therapy modalities, how we work together, what you do with clients, and what's kind of coming out as a way for people to heal, like now, and what's coming in the future. So thanks for being here.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Thanks for having me. I've also been very much looking forward to talking. So, yeah.
Oh, good. Yay. Well, I'd love for you to kind of share your story first, and then we can kind of maybe share the story of working together. So, how did you decide to become a therapist, and what's your personal journey?
Sure. Yeah, I kind of think about, yeah, I usually start like about 7, 8 years ago, which was I was in my early 30s, about 32. I'm 41 now. And at that time, I had just started my psychiatry training at Harvard Medical School. And so it was sort of the, in a way, an end of a lot of preparation. So I had done college, and then right after I went into medical school at UCLA. Right in the middle of medical school, I took time off to do a year of research at the National Institutes of Health. And then I liked that, so I decided to go into and get an actual PhD. So I took an even bigger break from med school, went to England, got a PhD in immunology, and then went back to finish medical school. So I did something like 15 straight years of school right before sort of when I think my big healing, my true healing started happening at 32. And so at that time, yeah, I was in Boston, and I had sort of, you know, achieved all these external things that I thought would make me happy. You know, I had sort of been someone who kept putting hoops in front of myself and thinking, oh, if I achieve this, if I get into a good med school, I'll be happy. And then I got to med school, I was happy for a month or two. And then I'm like, oh, no, now I've got it figured out. Oh, if I've got to get into a good residency, or, you know, a PhD at that point. And then like, okay, then I worked towards that. That happened again, was happy for a short time, wasn't again. And then, you know, same thing with residency. And so at 32, I had sort of finished off my first year of medical training, hit another bump where I was just miserable. And, but then I sort of ran out of hoops to jump through, right? I had really, unless I was going to go get an MBA, which I actually considered, I really had to sit with myself. And I was like, finally, like, I am not happy with my life. And it was something that was hard to face because I'd never really sat back and thought about it. You know, I was just on this like hamster wheel of education. And so I also looked very different. I was in a very different stage of my life. So I know we're going to get into drugs and psychedelics, which is why I mentioned that. So at that time, I did not have long hair, no piercings, no jewelry.
I like this look, by the way.
Yeah. So if you do psychedelics, you have to grow your hair and pierce your ears. So at least. So no, but I bring that up because at that time had been raised Jehovah's Witness as a kid. And so I had left the church at 15 because it was a very traumatic experience. And we can get into that if you want later. But I had not been spiritual at that time. I would have considered myself atheist or agnostic. Again, I'd smoked pot like a handful of times in my life, and I'd never touched a psychedelic. And so I hadn't really ever been in therapy before. And so I went into psychotherapy for the first time, and it was like traditional psychoanalysis. I was on the couch 4 days a week for like 3.5 years, just like, you know, exploring my mind for the first time. And so it was during that process that it was interesting. A childhood friend that I had grown up with here in Southern California, we sort of took an opposite path, and he had like got into a band after high school, didn't go to college, but then around the same time he decided to actually go to college. So at 32, he was in his freshman year of college, and he started doing psychedelics at that time, interestingly. And then so for a while he was like, Will, you've got to try. He's like, I'm, you know, trying this new psychedelic, it's doing this and that. And I was like freaked out. I'm like, you know, he's gonna lose his mind, he's gonna get addicted. So this is all happening at the same time, like our two paths were just like, yeah, coalescing there. And then, you know, I had tried by that time many antidepressants, and everything kept not only not working, but some of the antidepressants were making me feel worse, right? And here I was at like, quote, the best, you know, training psychiatry program in the world, potentially. And I was like, I can't even make myself feel better. And so even though I'm smiling right now, it was one of the two big major depressive episodes that I've had. And I became suicidal. I thought about dropping out. And so, yeah, all of this was happening. And then my friend was at what he like kept pushing the psychedelics thing. And he's like, no, Will, he's like, they used to do research on this in the 50s and 60s. They found it was helpful. I'm like, yeah, right. No, they don't. And so I went to PubMed, which is our search engine. Lo and behold, all of these articles came up from that time period. And they were like by the some of the best researchers in the country, published in really good journals. And that was the first time where I'm like, hey, did Is it true that, you know, the government may have lied to us and they took these off the market and said they were dangerous because of the anti-war movement? And so then I started looking into that, and it seemed to be really playing out that way. Like, there wasn't real evidence that these were dangerous or addictive. And so to sort of finish up this part of the story, and then it just synchronicities really started happening at that time, where I was working right next door to a doctor who had done research on psychedelics at Harvard. He was the only doctor, one of the few in the country at the time, who had done research. And so I knocked on his door, and eventually I tried a psychedelic, and it was like this beautifully opening experience where it was also very scary, and we can get in more into that, but it was basically like powerful enough to where I was like, there's something bigger at play here. You know, I'm connected to something greater, and there's something more for me here. And it was enough of a wake-up call to at least start really believing, yeah, that something could change. And that really catapulted the last like 8 years. But anyway, I knocked on this doctor's door after trying it, and I'm like, hey, can you start telling me about these? And then, you know, lo and behold, at the same time, the research was really picking up in psychedelics. Really, in the last 2 years, it's been in the news a lot. But, you know, this was 2013, 2012. And so at that time, there wasn't really much noise about it. And so, yeah, he ended up connecting me to the researchers, and I got trained to use MDMA in therapy, and eventually got trained in ketamine, and used a lot of psychedelics myself. I shouldn't say it that way, maybe a lot, but I started using psychedelics for myself and my own healing. And it was really, really transformative. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I ended up, where I am now. And so I'm a psychiatrist, I'm a medical doctor, so I can prescribe. So that's kind of, yeah, professionally on the cover what I do. But I'm proud to say I have not prescribed an antidepressant since like 2015. So
wow,
very much I do not practice like a psychiatrist. So that's me in a nutshell.
It's crazy to think that you were so down and out, and that you were thinking about dropping out and feeling suicidal. And it, I don't want to say like serendipitously, like this, you came in contact with all of these people that opened your world up in a completely different way. And I mean, just to think that hours of your life flipped your life on its head is, I think, why this is such a major topic that people are talking about. Because to feel that low in such a beautiful world, I think about like nature, like the rainforest or the safari, like to be in the ocean in California, like just to experience your life in the present and to not feel so down and out or depressed or suicidal, like that would be a gift I'd want to give everyone who felt the way that you're feeling. Mm. It's I'm thankful for you and for your work. I want to demystify it. I want to talk about what it is. I don't know very much, if anything, about it. So what is the difference between MDMA and ketamine? And let's take a step back. Do people need to start there? Because we've worked together and we haven't gone there. So can you talk about how you work with clients and the progression of how you might work with clients to help keep them off medication, to help them heal their trauma?
Yeah.
And really, like, what is the difference between what we think and what's in our body? I know you talk about healing the mind and healing the body. Can we kind of talk about your work today?
Yes, absolutely. So it was interesting. I'll tell a little story. I don't know. I was driving to see a client today. And I do house calls a bit that I started doing during COVID. And I don't know, this view came for me in terms of like each of us being like prisms. And I know we haven't gotten into like spirituality or religion yet, but you know, I think of like, you know, our soul or the light that enters each of us, right? And that emanation of that light through that prism is so unique. And it's really our potential, right? I think each of us have, you know, a potential calling, a potential unique gift to give the world, right? And as I was thinking about this image of like, you know, light coming in, prism, and this like beautiful, unique emanation from it, is that, you know, when I think of trauma, and I put that in quotes, because I mean, there is trauma, which is, you know, a rape or war trauma, but there's many, many other forms. I mean, I think neglect, you know, having a parent that's emotionally not available, alcoholic, et cetera. I mean, nobody really escapes it. The way I think about those things is that those things sort of kind of put dirt and different amounts of dirt onto that prism. So only some of the light comes out, or the color of the light gets changed. And so practically the things I think about like that are, you know, for instance, so we have traumas. We can also have cultural influences, right? Things that say you should or shouldn't act like this. This is what you should aim for. You should have this kind of a life by the time you're 30. You should have this many kids. Or religion does a number on us, right? This is what pleasure should look like, shouldn't look like. And so, you know, whether it's culture, religion, family values, etc., there's all these things that start making us question how we can emanate and be in the world. And so when I think of the healing journey, it's about how do we remove the clutter? Well, first I think about, you know, if I think of my work in a nutshell, it's like, first of all, it's showing people that we are a prism. I mean, if people don't want to believe that we're prisms that can really do something beautiful, then you can go see someone else. But at the very least, you know, that's the foundation. And then it's showing people that, oh, and then, you know, we have these things that are no fault of our own that have clouded us, that have impacted our mind and have impacted our body. And I'll say more about that in a second. And that, you know, if we remove these, like, you know, you can live a more aligned life, you know, live the life that we're supposed to be living. And I make the distinction between mind and body there, again, because some of the messaging that we get to not be ourselves or be this way or be that way are in the mind, right? We have language by then. We're like 5 to 12 is usually like this window where like shit goes down when we're 5 to 12. And yeah. And but there's other stuff that happens before, you know, we have language. You know, it could be birth trauma. It could be child, like infant or very young child sexual abuse and stuff that we hold in the body. And we can have combinations of that sort of stuff. And so whenever we sort of block like who we are at the most true self, that causes pain, right? If we like cover that prism, that energy is going to get stored in the prism, right? As heat or something else. And so that's what I think about as symptoms, right? To me, symptoms, whether it's sadness, fear, shame, you know, as I was experiencing, like I had held in so much over the course of my life that I was experiencing a ton of sadness, which in psychiatry we call depression, but it's really just intense sadness, right? Because I wasn't living life the way I'm supposed to be living. And so to me, like, these are all inroads to let me know when I'm working with someone, where is the source of that pain? Because that pain I think of as a gift. Like if I wasn't sad deeply, what would even motivate me to live a different life? You know, and so whether it's, you know, again, an emotion like sadness, fear, shame, or it's a physical pain, right? Some people we hold in and we're not consciously aware of it, but it can cause, you know, intensities in the chest or if it's in the belly, at the sort of second chakra, you know, that can be some digestion problems. If it's throat stuff, like because we can't speak or we hold back, then that can be sort of swallowing and other types of, or TMJ and jaw clenching sort of a stuff. So that's kind of the way I look at this healing work in a nutshell. And so obviously you and your listeners are very aware of like these different methods, and wellness is really expanding to get at these different, you know, chunks and try to clear the prism. And psychedelics are another tool in that armamentarium, which simply facilitate this removal of the junk, whether it's mind or body. And I think of, you know, they are related, but there can also be differences in ejecting these sort of old stories from our bodies or our minds.
I love that you call them old stories and just the visualization of the prism and the dirt, because it, like, obviously it's bringing up so many things for me. I'm like, okay, I was raised in a conservative Catholic family. Like I have had these ideals of like what success looked like, much like you, like how many years am I going to go to school? And you know, how many kids am I going to have? And like all of these sort of like external attainment or what you do, what you don't do. And I see how dampening that can be and how darkening that can be. And we worked together after Sebastian's birth, after 6 months of regular talk therapy. And I've told so many people this, but I walked into your office and 75 minutes or an hour and a half later, I walked out and went, okay, I'm better. Like, and I laugh, but like it was really transformative for me. And we didn't use what you call the tool of psychedelics, but you did get at parts of the dirt on my prism that I think I couldn't release talking about it I don't know if you remember, but I talked about this birth story for 6 months and couldn't, I was crying about it and it felt like I was picking a scab and it was like getting scar tissue. Like it was just getting like worse almost and like harder to talk about. But can you talk about what the tools are that you use first and how, I mean, once you assess someone and try to like see their prism in the dirt, then how do you clear it away?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, even though it's interesting, I know I was sort of presenting psychedelics as a tool, but as you were talking, in a way, the only tool we need is ourselves. Like our body naturally ejects this stuff if we allow it, you know what I mean? And we're usually just hindering the body from doing what it wants to do. And the other stuff is just extra. So it's really, you know, I think about like, you know, an example that is often talked about in the sort of the body work sort of world of trauma is, you know, if we think of an animal that say it's like a bird flies into like our window because it doesn't see the window in it, like, you know, gets knocked out for a second. It will get up, it'll wake up, it'll chirp, it'll flap its wings, it'll shake. And it just moves on. Then it keeps flying, you know, like a week or two later, it's not thinking like, oh shit, like I better watch out. There might be another window that I might crash into and I better do this different. Like, you know what I mean? The shaking of that energy, right, when it happens is their release of this stuff. And when we don't do that, again, because I mean, a common story that I grew up with, this is like boys don't cry, right? In a Latino family and being a man, it's like, okay, you get to a certain age and you mature. Or even the medical system pushes this stuff on us. And it's like, then we hold that back and we just like we don't allow ourselves or give ourselves permission, right? Because it's like this story in my head of I should or shouldn't do that keeps me from doing the thing that my body naturally wants to do. And it actually takes effort to not do that, right? But it becomes so natural and it becomes so unconscious. Like these are just habits that we start building that we like watch our family. We watch the people around us. How do they deal with emotion, you know? And so in your case, you know, it's like a common thing, right? I mean, it's one level and it is important to start talking about a story because there's many, many people that I see who often, you know, by the time we're done doing work, have told me 4, 5, 6, 7 stories that they've never told anybody, you know? So that just usually shows that it's like this thing that cannot be accessed. And it's like, when I think about how do I help someone, it's like, how do I facilitate them feeling permission to just feel, right? And so it depends on the person and the sort of dirt on how we do that. And so sometimes that takes more talking because it's just like this is a very scary thing to let themselves do this. And sometimes, you know, people, if they've done a lot of that work and understand the situation verbally, but they haven't physically released it, then, you know, sometimes it's just under the surface, like kind of in your case, right? Where again, you knew the story and all this, but it's just like, I felt like you hadn't given yourself permission to just say, no, this was really, you know, I kind of remember actually some details from your session at this point, but I'll let you go into it as much as you can. But it was like, you know, I think about it sort of similar. I actually thought about you about a little over a month ago because I was having a tooth pulled and I had a fracture in a tooth. I was in Mexico traveling in February and I had bitten into this bone and it like literally fractured my tooth in half. And it was like the most painful thing I've ever experienced. 6 weeks later, which is insane to even say, like I walked around with this tooth for six weeks. Like, cause again, this is, I've done a lot of work on myself, but this was one thing I wasn't giving myself permission to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, I ended up going to this dentist and they saw the tooth and they were like, how have you been walking around with this? Like, he's like, this is an emergency. And he's like, I'm going to call my friend right now to see if they can remove it. And he's like, are you willing to go this morning? Just when he said that, I started crying. Like I had been in so much pain, but I've just learned to like not feel.
Yeah.
But it was like, just hearing him be like, this is an emergency. He's like, how did you do this? I was like, fuck. Like, it was finally like, yeah. And then I went over to the other dentist who was the oral surgeon. And it was a really hard surgery. I mean, she was like tugging and tugging and tugging. And I've never had really any major medical or physical surgeries or anything like that. And in the middle of her tugging, she was having a really hard time. I guess I'm somehow blessed and cursed with good bone structure, but like, she could not get this thing out. So she had to like bust out the drill and like grind the tooth. And again, I just started bawling because it was like, it hurt and it was scary. And like, and she stopped and like, I picked her specifically and I waited in part because I like wanted to feel comfortable with the person. And she and the other like assistant were like rubbing my chest as I'm like crying, but I didn't actually feel ashamed when I was doing it. I was like, I don't like, I'm just going to let this happen. But I remember being like, I'm literally smelling my burnt, like sanding of my bone. Like, because I'm like, there's nothing normal about this. And at the end, like, yeah, she was like, I'm proud of you. Like, good, you did that. Anyway, I was literally like, I think in that chair, I thought about you because I thought about our session and I'm like, this is the stuff. And, you know, I feel good after. And if I hadn't done that, maybe I would have gotten worsening teeth grinding or something else. So anyway, that's an example. And I think you did sort of a version of that where,
it was releasing,
holding onto this thing for a long time and you just gave yourself permission to do it.
Well, it was interesting because I don't know what was the catalyst, because I had gone to, you held space for me. That was the difference, like in a different kind of way, to tell the story in a different kind of way. I went into our session knowing I was releasing from my body and that I wasn't going to be afraid of crying and I wasn't going to try to talk my way through the why it happened, which I still tend to do sometimes. And I'm sure, like, if I think in my heart, like, you maybe healed me 85% there or 90%, there may be like, if we met again, I'd let a little bit more go because it was a pretty intense experience. But I remember even in the birth of Sebastian and such, like the trauma of having my baby taken away and being like, the nurses being like, are you okay? I'm like, and me consoling Chris, like, it's going to be okay, babe. Like, we're going to be okay. He's going to be okay. And sort of more into like a, like I was crying, like light tears of like this, I can't believe this is happening. And I would go through like, maybe like my tears would rev up a little bit later in those 24 hours, but I never had that shaking coyote in the, you know, like out on the plains, howling, crying that I had in your office, which was insane. Yeah. Like you just had me tell the story and I don't know, the instrument you were playing was from India, I think is what you said. Yeah. What was that called?
It's called a Shruti box, which is like a, it's kind of a type of it's a harmonium or like an accordion type thing, which I play just to allow people to sort of lose themselves a bit more and sort of dissociate into the body. Yeah,
it was interesting because I think it gave, because you were playing it loud, like as I would cry louder, you played it a little louder, like it allowed for me to not think that I was the loudest thing in the room, even though I probably was. And you just told me to keep crying. And at one point I remember having to stand up from the chair. And I mean, who decided that high-waisted mom jeans were the way to go without zero stretch at that period of time? I had to like stand up, if you remember, unbutton my jeans and take my booties off, like my boots, because I felt like my ankles were constricted and my waist was constricted and I couldn't catch my breath.
Yeah.
But it just, like, you just held the space for me and you consoled me through the situation. And I didn't need to take psychedelics to go there. I just really wanted it to go away. Like I wanted like the underlying buzzing of sadness that I felt for my, for Bash, for not being with him, for fearing like trauma I caused him, like all of the like self-blame and all of it. Like I just, I wanted to eject it.
Yeah. And you were ready, you know, and you told some of the, you know, these stories now I remember about, you know, like thinking about your husband at the same time and also Sebastian. But I also remember there was a point where I remember like the way the doctor responded, or one of the doctors, it was just very clinical, you know, and it wasn't seeming like, you know, I was just talking about how like I was crying and bawling from having like my tooth pulled, right? But like, I don't know, there was a point where I was thinking just like all the things that have, that took you to that moment of giving birth, where I don't know, just 9 months of carrying this child, the hopes and dreams and thinking about, you know, you even talked about, you know, earlier today, when I was talking about some of the programming, you're like, oh, this is the family I should have kids, I should have this kind of a job. I mean, you know, how long are women thinking about a baby, the baby? And so it's like, I think of all of that stuff in the background, like focused into that one moment, and boom, like, right, all this fear comes in and this doubt and all this stuff. And I'm like, how could you not be screaming? Like, my God, you know, but it's like, again, all these things around you were like, you thought you had to take care of this and that. And like, I don't know, like, I just think, yeah, there was just so much going on that I was like, wow, like just wanting to help you release that. Cause as you said, there was a howling, and it was just like, again, the term keeps coming up. How could one not respond that way? You know what I mean? Like that, it's absolutely a terrifying experience that you had gone through. So.
Yeah. I think it's the world. Like, it's what you say. Yeah. It's these expectations that we are supposed to have it together and we're not supposed to cry. And I even think with my sons, like I really try to be conscious of not like, you're okay. It's, yeah. Are you okay? Like not, you're okay. Because I grew up like, shake it off. You're okay. You got this. Yeah. You're okay. And like, my parents didn't mean anything by it. And they do it with my kids and all of, you know, the aunts and uncles, everybody like, you're okay. Yeah. You know? And it's not like checking in, like, are you okay? Maybe it's made me super resilient, but when it comes to things not going right, I don't even ask myself, are you okay?
Mm, beautiful. Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's like you take care of yourself last in a way.
Yeah. And I'm so thankful to be in this space and working in wellness, because it is teaching people that they need to put their own oxygen mask on first and to find ways to get the dirt off their prism and heal themselves. So if someone were to come to you and work with you, I mean, I obviously was quote ripe or ready to cry and howl in your office,
yeah.
But if people are walking around with sadness, and you just said that, you know, you sometimes work with people and they tell you five stories they've never told anyone else. How is it that you pull stories out of them, and when would you decide to use psychedelics to help healing?
You know, I just see what people are ready for, you know, in terms of following the lines of what's ailing them, you know, and it's sort of just, yeah, taking one's time, because if you try to sort of jump in there too quickly, it can cause someone to pull away and feel unsafe. And so safety is a big thing that I think about, a big word in permission, right? Is that for all these stories that we've told ourselves are versions of not giving ourselves permission. And so the timing sort of has to be right for someone to have the release. One thing I wanted to mention before is though, that as you were, it was interesting as you were saying, you know, your parents, you know, have this like, you're okay, or, you know, you're, and aunts and uncles, is how this stuff is very much, I mean, this is under the umbrella I think of as like inherited, you know, actually inherited trauma. Actually, we can maybe call it inherited trauma or transgenerational trauma, you know, because these are just ways that families have learned to cope. And before the age of five, it's like, if we think of everything that children are observing, just facial expressions, even. I mean, there's people who, because their parents don't allow themselves to give, you know, make certain facial expressions, kids stop doing it. You know, so there's all these ways that we never think about because it's just normal in our family. And so, yeah, you know, the fact that, again, you said aunts and uncles, it's like, this is just the way someone at some point in the lineage learned to cope, and no one thought about it. It just kept getting passed on and passed on and passed on. It sounds like you're adding, you know, an adjustment to it. You're like, okay, well, I'm going to at least turn it into a question, you know, and just, and so, yeah, I don't know. I wanted to point that out because a lot of the times it's not like this stuff is obvious to us. It's just, this is the way we learned how to deal with emotion. And so the reason why for me, like these images of like a prism and dirt is on it is because to me, then anytime I hear, you know, so one, what method could be like listening to someone's story. And again, if they're telling me a story of something that happened and they're not showing or connecting with emotion, that's sort of like an easy tell. It's just like, okay, like, well, you understand it here, but your body's not understanding it. Or sometimes people don't know what is ailing them at a conscious level. They just say, I'm anxious or I'm depressed, which is meaning usually if I'm anxious, it's like, oh, there's fear that hasn't been released. Or if they're depressed, it's like sadness that has not been released. You know, those are usually the two major emotions that we suppress, or shame is like the big third one. And so it's just sort of following the lead, and it's kind of like a little puzzle to find, you know, kind of where the dirt is. And so it's kind of fun. It's very simple, but it's also fun because every person is so unique. And so, I mean, in terms of psychedelics, you know, I think of them simply as amplifiers. So the work that we did, for instance, like you can think of a session, say, with MDMA, which is the major psychedelic that's on track for getting legalized first, which it's still a couple of years away, but you know, that would basically, we could get sort of the work that we got done at that intensity. But we could probably do probably about 4, 6, 8, 10 more rounds of it in one day, because they're like 8 or 10 hour sessions. But the seeing the story that we have created, seeing the limitation that we put on ourselves, or accessing the physical emotion is facilitated like many, many fold. It's almost like you don't have to try. It's just a major, major amplifier to the process itself. And so, you know, it's hard to say like when I would step in with a psychedelic, because to me, it's like if I could use it with everyone, probably within a month or two of seeing everyone, they could really benefit. But because these are currently still in research, yeah, it's difficult. It's a little bit of a painful time for a lot of the practitioners, because like we know we have this powerful tool, but it's so limited to us right now.
Can you explain what MDMA and ketamine are? Like, what are they derived from? And like, what's the experience like? What do most people feel like? How long does it last? What is it in milligrams? Like, I want to know everything.
Yeah,
I know nothing.
So yeah, so let's start with MDMA perhaps. So MDMA is like, you know, people, it's a drug that's been, it was discovered like in the, I think the 19-teens, like 1915 or something, by a drug company called Merck. But they were sort of, the medication was tucked away until the 70s. And then in the 70s, it sort of came out as a drug in therapy, actually. So MDMA was used in therapy, for couples therapy primarily, through the 70s and then the very early 80s, in order to just facilitate this process that we're talking about. But also around that same time in the 80s, it started becoming used in the recreational scene. And eventually it was put into ecstasy, which had its big moment in the 90s. And so most people think of MDMA as ecstasy, even though they're a little bit different. The way I think of it working, the pharmacology, I mean, we could go into the neurotransmitters and stuff. I don't find that stuff, I mean, I can tell you if you want, but to me, like the experiential part is what matters most. And so what it does though, is it sort of, it increases activity in the frontal lobes, which is where we process. It also decreases activity in something called the amygdala, which is usually our alarm system. So right now, all the research with MDMA has basically been in PTSD. So we take people with the worst trauma, with the worst stories, when we wanted to test it out in that fashion to see, can we get, you know, kind of the people who are most limited and are most covered with dirt to heal. And we've seen tremendous results. And so turning down the amygdala is like turning down the alarm system, right? People with PTSD are always in fight or flight because they think they're in danger, right? They've held on to all of these very terrifying and life-threatening stories. And so when you can then facilitate that, that allows all these big releases. And then the memory storage of that trauma is sort of put in the past, right? Because in a way, like what we're talking about is the story about, you know, with you when you were giving birth, or me with my tooth, is that if those kind of things aren't released, they are brought to the forefront because the body's trying to say, let's get rid of this so we can move on. But again, we usually ignore it. And so in part, that's how these work different, is that, you know, we're used to suppressing. And a lot of what we've talked about today is suppressing with our behavior, right? Our culture has said suppress, our families have said suppress, religion has said suppress. And we do the same things within psychiatry, right? If you look at the categories of our medications, antidepressant, anti-anxiety, antipsychotic, we're also suppressing. So you know, we're living at a time where we've suppressed the heck out of everything. And so that's why these are so novel, they work different. And that's why we're seeing, like, you know, we're curing things in psychiatry finally. And it's because instead of saying suppress, we're saying, let's bring to the surface, like, let's allow it all.
Yeah.
So that's in general how they work. So yeah. And, you know, yeah, long story short, like MDMA, you give a couple of doses, we could get into the milligrams, but you do it during a therapy session. Mm-hmm. And you've worked with these therapists already for about 4 to 5 sessions ahead of time. So you get to know them, you get comfortable with them, and it's 2 therapists per 1 patient. So you have a male and a female, you know, because it's a long session, but also it feels safer. It's safer for everybody. You know, if a yeah. woman has had sexual trauma, you know, to have 2 people in the room, you know, sometimes it can be helpful to have a man, sometimes it's not, but at least you have 2 sort of people taking care of you. So when we're talking about what helps someone feel safe and have permission, we're trying to maximize it with that. And yeah, and you start pretty early in the morning. And so the sessions usually last around 8 or 9 hours. And then you continue doing the weekly therapy for some weeks after. So it's not just like the experience itself. It's really just thought of as part of the entire process that happens over the course of a few months. So That's MDMA therapy in a nutshell.
If someone were to do MDMA therapy, is it something that they would have, you know, sometimes people say like drug withdrawals or like a hangover, would there be something where, wow, this is like a really, I'm assuming it would be just like a crazy emotional day, watching the Goop series or, you know, some things that are available on Netflix, you can kind of see this process unfold. But do people feel like they're present during the session, like, and that they're able to use like all their faculties? Do you know what I mean?
It's interesting. I would say you can use different faculties. And so part of what I didn't mention, and so people take the MDMA and they have the opportunity, and we suggest wearing an eye mask and music the entire time. And so, because what that helps is it facilitates getting out of the mind as much as possible. And so I actually prefer, when I do sessions with people, I actually ask them to keep the eye mask on at least for 4 hours straight. And you know, some of the most powerful sessions I've had, you know, the clients have kept them on the entire time. So 8 or 9 hours. So it's like you decrease all of the outside stimulus as much as possible. And then you cause this like internalization where you just go into yourself. And so sometimes, in a very powerful way, like I've had multiple MDMA sessions myself, but you know, some of the most powerful ones for me have been where I was almost in a dissociated state. The therapist actually ended up telling me after that I was like, I was like making these like suckling movements with my mouth, or I was doing certain shaking with my hips or my legs. And I don't even remember having done that, but it was like almost like pre-verbal, or I had dissociated and I was just body, you know? Wow. So we talk about how most people are in mind. Few people are mostly just in body, but we're trying to creep here. And then during the peaks of some of these sessions, people are all body, and it's just movement, just catharsis, tears. It can be screaming. And so, yeah, it's interesting because like some people have worried and resisted MDMA therapy because they're like, is this going to encourage people to just like take ecstasy all the time and people are going to be tripping out? But it's, and if you think about it, like there's this one quote that we actually always go to. There's a patient that was in one of the research studies that's been interviewed, and he says this beautiful quote. He says, "I don't know why they call this ecstasy, because it's just like, it's not this like happy, pleasant experience. It's actually a very intense, it's a very powerful, dense experience." And so, you know, we don't see depression after MDMA, you know, like in the rave scene, we used to see that. I think it's mostly impurity of drug or too much, like a lot high dose. So we don't see people get depressed after MDMA therapy. You know, there's some people who, again, with the sessions in the weeks that happen after, you continue processing, because it would be great if like it was all packaged all in one day where it came up, it's moved out, and then we're all good. But sometimes it takes the body a little longer to release, you know, because it's sometimes been decades of trauma that's been released. So,
wow. Yeah. So powerful. And what would be, and what is ketamine? Is that another drug company's version of MDMA, or is it completely different? Like,
yeah. So when I think of psychedelics, like, you know, there's a lot of what's being written out there is psychedelic therapy, but it's much more complex, and we're going to see over the next few years that that's the case, right? But, you know, MDMA is, I consider, a psychedelic. And then there's like the classic psychedelics, like people think of mushrooms, LSD, ayahuasca has been in the news enough where I think a lot of people have heard of it. And then ketamine is like another fifth. And I think of those as kind of like the big five right now. And they each have uniqueness in terms of, say, how quickly they can open up the mind or the body, how in depth can they do it, and how much of mind or body they do. And so there's lots of subtleties, and we could talk for hours about it. But, you know, MDMA, I think of as the heart opener. It helps us really reach very traumatic experiences, very painful things, but with like trust and love. It's like taking a buddy in to revisit these old memories. And to me, that's my favorite of them. I mean, it's just such, it's a kind.
It's not scary.
Yeah, it's less like taking a buddy. It's like taking an aunt that you trust or a grandmother. You know, it's like you're going to go into the worst thing, but you're going to have this feminine, soft, trusting energy with you. And so that's in general the way I think of MDMA. On the other end of the spectrum, I think of like ayahuasca, which is kind of like taking your like harsh uncle with you. You know, like, yeah, like there's nothing gentle about ayahuasca. And the other ones are sort of in the middle.
Got it.
I mean, you asked about ketamine, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And ketamine's probably getting the most press right now because it's the only one that's currently prescribable by all doctors. And so you're seeing more and more clinics pop up. It's probably my least favorite of any of them, because and I've basically gotten to the point where I'm not using it much anymore with people. It's really good at certain things. Like for depression, it can be very good to sort of pop someone out of a deep depression. But I have not found that it's a good medicine to help people move and catharse things. And by nature, ketamine is a dissociative. So it's an anesthetic, like at its foundation. And if you think about that, it's like, it's an anesthetic because we can cut into the skin and organs and people don't feel anything. So at high doses, mind and body are completely separate.
Yeah.
So that can provide beautiful relief for people if they've been depressed or anxious, because all of a sudden you have your awareness, your consciousness, but your body is disconnected, which even for a little, if it's an hour, that can be very relieving for people. And it can also just give them hope, because they're like, oh, this, I'm not this thing. I'm separate from it.
Yeah.
But because it also separates the two, it, like when you're having all these realizations, the body is disconnected. So you're not so, you know, I've never seen strong catharses with ketamine. I don't see these releases. And so, I don't know, it's a little bit of a different one. And it's fallen out of favor a bit for me, just because it doesn't unroot the...
It does. It seems like you're just disassociating instead of curing, healing, or clearing what you're, I mean, and that's the goal of using these, would be to get rid of the dirt. And it sounds like you're moving the dirt for an hour and putting it right back on.
Yeah. Which again, for some people, if they're really, really struggling existentially, to give them that like little
relief,
bit of hope can be enough. But my concern is if people and practitioners start to use these more as less frequent than daily medications, but if it just becomes like a routine, you've got to do it every week or something like that. So,
yeah. Well, you talk a lot about like living your authentic life and being in alignment with your true values. And you use these tools to help people, I think, become this bright prism. What advice would you have for someone who feels like down and out, or they're feeling anxious, or they're seeing a therapist and they're not finding tools? Like, what do you mean by that when you...
Yeah. So that brings up something up for me, which is, it reminds me of something that you said earlier, or when you asked me something about how do we release this stuff, is that if you think about it, there's no reason why you had to come see me to do this, right? Like, I mean, in some ways it helps to, in some ways it helped you, give you permission to do this, right? But what was I doing? I was sitting in a room with you, and for some reason, because of our interaction, you felt safe enough, right? But like, what do I think about when I do something in the room with someone? I'm hopefully providing a presence that's trusting, that's empathic, that's non-judgmental, that's protective. Like, none of those traits are things that I learned in psychiatry, right? Like I'm basically talking about what I wish most human beings were doing, right?
Yeah.
So in theory, if we kept people, you know, normally because we've accumulated dirt, we've usually kept people in our life that have complementing dirt, whether it's partners or friends or our family. Certainly it's not dirt that we can get rid of there. So like, you know, we've essentially in a way unconsciously structured our life that supports each other's dirt.
Yeah.
And not in a malicious way, but that's just
right.
The way we've set it up. And so, you know, I would say that, you know, if we're trying to sort of live more authentically, is to really start noticing. So where am I not living authentically? And usually that's four areas, you know, the areas of our relationships with other people. It's like family, friends, our work, and our romance, right? And so I usually get people to, you know, usually it's one in those four categories that people come in and say, I'm not happy about this. Or honestly, it's more like usually people are more unhappy with two or three or four of them.
Yeah.
So it's just trying to tease out like, okay, so what's not in alignment? Why isn't it in alignment? And just seeing. So, I mean, in a way, one doesn't have to come see me. You don't have to do psychedelics. But if you can be just thoughtful about this stuff and saying, where am I really not living my life? And where did I get off? And just, yeah, start doing these little micro alignments along the way is a way to do it. You know, and if some people don't serve us anymore, or they aren't along on that journey, then, you know, is it time to say goodbye or to shift? You know, and so that can be usually the hardest thing, because we've set our life up a certain way. You know, often people will also be like, well, I'll change them then. If this person or this person changes, then I could be happy, right? There's a lot of people that are in that mode. And so, yeah, that's a little bit of how I look at someone's life in terms of, you know, how they're living it and helping them find the alignment for themselves.
It's so interesting that we set our life up to have the same dirt as the people around us. I feel like it's probably like what feels safe. It's familiar. Totally. It's what we're like, not that we're like attracted to ourselves, but I feel like aren't a lot of people. And so it's really interesting. And you bring up a good point. It's not at a certain point though, it's not a micro adjustment. Like if they have waited or if they have tried to fix someone else or tried to think it's going to be better when we do X, Y, and Z, or like a family vacation, or, you know, when I get that raise, or like pick your attainment goal that's in the future, that's not now, then it sounds like it becomes a major life adjustment. And I think that people are probably afraid of that. I mean,
absolutely.
You don't want to open Pandora's box and have to make a major life change. What would the world say about that?
Precisely. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And you hit it on the head. This is exactly what it is. Sometimes there are these little shifts, but sometimes we do have to take a big U-turn, right? Like literally like I said, that was like the biggest gift in the end to me was this depression and suicidality. Cause it was either like, again, but I was looking to put another hoop, another accomplishment. I like just literally like ran out. So then I had to be like, now what? And so, you know, these symptoms aren't doing anything bad, right? This is my body saying like, I really want you to like, listen to me. You know, and so usually I think of the intensity of that symptom is usually just how far misaligned we are. And so, yeah, sometimes we do have to make big adjustments in relationships or career. And so, yeah, and it's painful in the beginning because it's usually scary. So,
but I would say like looking at you now and like the very authentic smile you have on your face, you are a bright light prism and you look very much in alignment with what you're supposed to be doing. And it's doing amazing things for everyone you come in contact with. And I just want everyone to have your knowledge and to know that this is out there. And I'm so thankful there are people like you. I mean, it was such a gift for me personally. And like we said, I don't know if it was before we started recording or not, but I've just felt the need when I'm working with certain people that this isn't about the food, you know, this isn't about the controlling of the food that's happening. Like this is like deeper than what you're willing to even tell me. And it's some above my pay grade is what I like to call it. Your pay grade. It needs to be unearthed and that dirt needs to go away because it's just this is all just a symptom of whatever is underneath. So I'm hopeful that there are going to be more practitioners like you, because I do think even though we all have the keys to and the tools to do what you're saying we do, which is just to like cry and release what we're holding on to, the permission is a big deal. Like having the appointment, having the place, knowing that this is what you're going there for. Like I just knew in my head, I'm just going to go bawl my eyes out in this guy's office. And apparently I'm going to feel a lot better. And yeah, like it was crazy. And even just saying it was crazy, like it wasn't crazy. That's the way I should have responded, like in the room, in the moment. Yeah. And I couldn't. So.
Yeah. And that's, there was nothing crazy about it. You know, I think I always use the word beautiful. You know, I have this, like, it's one of my teachers, he always says, he's like, we should cut things out of our language, like unbelievable, crazy. Because it's like, you know, when something really wonderful happens to us, if we label it as unbelievable, if we label it as crazy, we're saying we're saying it's these rare things or these things that shouldn't happen, where it's just like, no, this is the way it should be. You know, like, you should have just been able to feel that, release it, and then, have moved on. But like, I think that's to me, like bigger picture spirituality. I mean, I think this is why we're here, right? Like if we were all just prisms without gunk, it would be a beautiful world probably also, but you know, I think like whatever this time is right now and in 2021, it's like, we're here to remove our individual gunk and also our collective gunk. And so, I just think of myself as like one person in community, right? But it's like, if we all can start messaging our friends or our own communities, like you're doing, and giving everyone more permission, it's like eventually, you know, hopefully this kind of stuff maybe I'm looking for another job and maybe I go to business school because it's not necessary anymore.
No, it is so beautiful too, just because I think our junk and our dirt really influences how we interact with the people around us, and just the collective junk gets worse.
Yeah.
And totally. I think even just in the last year,
like the biggest example of that.
Yeah.
Like that, that he was, you know, Trump was only really again, he's a symptom, you know, like he it wasn't one man. I mean, there was plenty of that behavior. There still is, you know? And so it's like putting it in our face and saying, so how do we deal with this in our own little communities? Because we all of our communities have junk, right?
Yeah. It felt so like, it just feels like so split, so fractured. So yeah. Every topic, everything is like not from a place of like bright light prism love.
Yeah.
It feels like more protecting and like people trying to keep their light inside and not share it. And yeah. It would just be a completely different experience if we all just
it's just
popped our light.
Totally. I mean, we can absolutely. So I mean, I think that's what we're doing. And we're doing it slowly and with time, you know, just like these catharses. If we were to rip off all of the band-aids all in one time, it's overwhelming for us. And so yeah, I'm feeling optimistic now in 2021 that we're howling the collective howl.
Yeah.
I like that analogy that you gave. I'm gonna,
you can use howl. It. You can
I
take
should
that
keep
one
some,
with
like, gold
you.
Stickers in my office. And for people that howl, I'm gonna give them a sticker.
You should. Positive reinforcement, hit a dopamine on their way out. Can you before we go, I just want, well, you'll tell everyone where they can follow along and find you, and we'll lead them to the research and where they can learn more. But what would your advice be for people to live their brightest life? Like what are some of your personal health hacks and ways that you're staying in touch and trying to remove your own dirt on the daily?
And I love that you said daily, because I think of like longer term alignments. I think of like major alignments, like you were talking about friends, family, career. What are my long-term plans and where am I putting my energy? And I also think of like daily alignments, you know, and misalignments. It's like the more alignments we have towards love and authenticity, our life will move that way. And if we have it in the other direction towards fear, it'll be that way, you know, and even little adjustments make a big difference. You know, like I think about like this thing that I like pick up, or with Instagram, it's like this is like literally like a dose of fear every time we pick it up, right? Or a dose of insecurity, and like just little things like that. It's like, what am I doing in my life that is like enhancing these insecurities, that are enhancing I'm not enough, that are enhancing I should be this way, you know? And so it's like listening to the little voices and just, yeah. I'm not answering your question very, very directly.
No, that's a very directed piece of advice,
like being
actually.
Attentive. It's like just realize, I think, like how much power and how beautiful this opportunity we have to like shine this light. I don't know. When I think of these prisms, I like literally think like, it's like the unique prism, which is each of us. It's like it has never existed in the history of humanity. It will never exist again. You know, so if we like keep our light sort of like, yeah, dimmed or suppressed. It's like, it's to me, it's such a sad thing. And so it's reaching for, and we talk about synchronicities and how important that was for me. I actually don't think that there was any less synchronicities at that time in my life than there had been. It's just, I was finally opening up to them. And so I think once people just start allowing this stuff to come, it's just the signs are there. The people are there. The situations are there to say yes to that, you know, that will help us. And then the people will also show up, and tests show up for us to say no. And so just to be aware and not lose hope.
It's really good practice, because what we are telling people to do is to tap into their intuition. And ooh. that really truly means like keeping all of those expectations, or what the world wants of you, what your parents want of you, what you thought you wanted of you, which I think is almost like, that one is like the most derailing, because it's the accumulation of everything you've learned, and then associating, like owning that personally and saying like, but I thought I wanted to be a doctor, but I thought I wanted, and then that's almost the hardest one to let go of, because who you are is wrapped up in that.
Yeah. And this brings up a concept that I think of as true values versus perceived values. And true values, I think, are the prism, is our us at our most authentic. And so I think that we are the only ones that know how we are supposed to be living. Like, and so, you know, I get sometimes, you know, wellness has just exploded also into a bit of an industry now. And it's like, everyone wants to tell you how to live. And like, there's also this concept of being in, likewise myself sometimes, but it's like, you can also, if you're so focused on healing or being what I call in trauma, you can stay in healing mode the rest of your life. Because it's like in the industry, honestly, the wellness industry is going to push for that. Because just like the medical industry who wants to keep us taking medicine, wellness wants to keep us trying to get well. Because
you can biohack that, Will. You can biohack that. And continue to biohack it until you're 95.
Exactly. And so I think that's one attentive thing is to just like, to really make sure that one is moving through and transcending, because I think there's beautiful, beautiful things available in the wellness community. But it's like, see, if we have to stay linked to one method or one book or one something for years, or, you know, it's a sign that something's not working, unless it's listening to your podcast or reading your books, of course, then that's the road.
I mean, you know, even with like what I've created or what I've written about, like, I want to be a tool for people. Like, I want to be a tool for trust. Like, I think that everyone's goal should be to continue to grow and to transcend and to expand and to change and like experience life in so many different ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's so much endless possibility that I think that a lot of people have talk themselves out of thinking that they could live the life that they really want. And I forgot, the reason I mentioned these true values versus perceived values, because again, I think we have our core true values, but then the reason I call them perceived values is because a lot of these stories became ingrained in our youth, right? By our parents, our religion, et cetera, that they can like almost like they can mimic true values. And so they can be so close that that's why it's painful, is because we have felt them to be part of us. And so, or again, another big one for a lot of people is like, well, look how many people are living life this way, right? Yeah. Social media is a massive culprit for that, because it's like, we're getting all these signals that this is happy. And so for us to say, no, I'm not going to listen to that, I'm going to live like this, it's really, really difficult. And so I think, especially for kids growing up with social media, it's like, we've never seen this, right? This 24/7 messaging on how to live. So
It is really heartbreaking, because that is one part of like social media and the internet. When I think about when I was raised before, I mean, the first social media thing was like AIM, like you were instant messaging your friends through AIM. And then there was MySpace, and then there was Facebook. But I mean, the comparison that I had as a child was like the other kids in my class. You know, it wasn't like I was watching the Kardashians and people were in Jordans and driving Rolls Royces. And even I think about adults, 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s, watching these reality TV stars and like these famous TikTokers or Instagrammers. And you're going like, now this is a perceived value that like attainment or that is going to make me happy. And again, that's just pushing down. That's making people have goals, those goals that feel like a macro adjustment when they want to change them.
So it can be very challenging, but I don't know, it feels to me that more and more of this is becoming conscious and more people are aware of it. And we can also see it in psychedelics. The funding of MDMA has all been through donations. It's been completely donations based. And even like Rebecca Mercer, like she donated $1 million from the Mercer family, which is representing what we would normally, you know, obviously associate with the right and conservatism. And you also get people from the liberals also really, really donating and supporting psychedelics. So it appears to be one thing that's really bringing people together. So I have some hope for it all.
Collective healing and the removal of dirt and lots of bright prisms walking around sharing the love.
Exactly.
Well, this is amazing. I mean, I really could talk to you for hours, and I have like 14 questions I didn't even ask you. So I just, I can't thank you enough for being here and for sharing your time. And I think there is one question I do actually want to ask you before we go, because I think it's the fear piece. And I wanted to touch on this. Is there, and I think there was a documentary on it on ecstasy back in the day, but talking about serotonin leaving your spinal cord and putting holes in your brain. Can you talk about, can you talk about what any like long-term effects or anything that's going to maybe happen to someone after they take MDMA?
Yes. I love that you mentioned holes in the brain. This is a really, really unfortunate story. So that's probably the one. I was actually working in Ethiopia during the end of my residency. I'd gone out there twice to do work, and I was in a rural part of Ethiopia. This is in 2014. And by that time, I had decided that I wanted to make psychedelics my career and part of my gift of the world for the world. And so I mentioned this to someone out there, and they're like, doesn't ecstasy give you holes in your brain? And like, it shook me to my core about how powerful communication and media is. So the only reason that story exists is because there was someone that was on Oprah in the late 90s, who, and it was a young woman who had taken ecstasy. And she had later gotten her brain scanned and had holes in her brain. She did have verifiable holes in her brain. So that got put out there, that ecstasy equals holes in the brain. What happened later was that she and her family were tested, and she had a congenital form of a cyst disease in the brain. So all of her family members had holes in the brain. And so they eventually found that this had nothing to do with ecstasy. And interestingly, I can't remember the complete details, but Rick Doblin from MAPS, who's the founder and executive director of MAPS, and MAPS is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. They are the reason why psychedelics are where they are right now. Was not too long ago now, a few years ago, I can't remember exactly how many, five or so, was asked to do a story for O Magazine because this stuff was picking up again. Yeah. Because back then, Oprah's organization had refused to actually correct the story, even though they admitted, yes, you were right. And so he actually said, sure, we'll do one, but will you agree to
admit it?
And they said no. And so the story was not run. And so, yeah. And like I said, I mean, why would anyone take ecstasy if again, the reach of Oprah, if you've got holes in your brain. And so I'm really glad that you brought that up. So there has been no serious adverse events in any of the phase 1, 2, and 3 trials for MDMA, none. And yeah, and psychedelics as a whole have now been shown to actually potentially grow new neurons and grow neurons in the areas of the brain that had never been shown that. So there's actually been, and this isn't me as like an advocate hippie being like, oh yeah, nothing's been shown to be dangerous. And
no.
You know, when we think about a full course of MDMA therapy, which is 4 months, weekly therapy, and then 3 times during that 4 months. So only on 3 days do you take MDMA. Most people don't ever have to do it again.
Wow.
Is that A, we've just shown that it's not safe. There are not long-term effects. The other thing is that people come off of medications and don't have to take them every day. So again, people are worried about because of all the programming on the dangerousness of drugs.
Yeah.
But I am much more worried about all our kids that are now on stimulants, on Adderall and Ritalin, and on antidepressants. Like that is a daily thing that you are giving someone like, you know, with a developing brain for years, you know, and wow. To me, like, you know, it's the messaging, but just because a doctor writes it, you know, that these are safe. And that to me, we don't know the long-term effects of doing that to an entire generation of children. So it's a long-winded way to say psychedelics have not been shown to be dangerous or addictive. So the addiction part, I want to mention too, because like addiction, if we think of things that are addictive, alcohol, right? If we're feeling anxious, we have a glass or two or five of wine, we're going to feel better, right? Because it's going to decrease anxiety for a period of time. Yeah. If I'm feeling really depressed and I take a stimulant like cocaine or Adderall, I'm going to feel good for a little bit. Things that are addictive take us out of what we're feeling, right? Everything that you've sort of learned so far, I guess, from our conversation is that like, if you take MDMA because you're feeling down, or if you take LSD because you're feeling anxious, you're not going to feel better. It's all going to hit you. And so like, these are not addictive. The one psychedelic that is, I think, in a category that can be abused and can probably lead to addiction is ketamine. Ketamine, and that's why it's not my preferred one because it does dissociate. So we feel good. We feel less pain in the short term. So that's the only one that I am not a big fan of. And I have some concern over abuse, but none of the other ones have been shown.
Oh, thank you so much for clearing that up. And I'm so glad I remembered to ask that last question because that was something really that I remember even hearing like back in high school, you know, like in the 90s, people, you know, knowing that people were doing it and hearing that and being like, I don't want holes in my brain.
Someone should go back and do a story on that. It's the number one thing that people always associate with it.
So. Yeah. Well, it's so good that we cleared that up and thank you so much for your time. And this is just it's such an informative episode. And I think people are going to learn a lot and they're going to learn that there is a great progression of learning how to remove your dirt and clear it and be okay ejecting things from your body and crying and howling if you need to. I'm finding a practitioner like you if they need to, but I will share all your information online. But where can people follow along? Where can they find you? Where can they learn more?
Yeah. So I basically just have an Instagram right now, will.su.md. That's just my only social media. Even that's a bit overwhelming. And then
I just have my
clinical website, which is just willcumd.com. So for people in the LA area, I practice here.
Well, I highly, highly recommend working with Will if you guys are listening and in the LA area. I think if you're going through something, it may even be worth flying there. I seriously love you so much. You changed my life. So thank you. You helped me recorrect, if you will,
Beautiful.
Keep that dirt away. So thank you so much for your time and for working with me back then.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And thanks for having me on. And thanks for doing the work that you do for the community.
Yeah, you too, Will.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.